Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Mercedes Benz v. Ryan.
May it please the court. If the decision of the Court of Appeals is allowed to stand, it will be the law in this state that any repossession of a motor vehicle that contains the debtor's personal property will be wrongful as a matter of law. It will also be the law in this state that any time a creditor is tendered a late payment, that creditor must choose either to repossess the collateral immediately or to give up the right to repossess non-judicially. We submit that neither of these results are supported by established law or sound public policy. Accordingly, we urge the court to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals and to render judgment that Mr. Ryan take nothing by his claims.
Counsel, isn't there an abundance of evidence showing a waiver?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And let me explain why. What we have is we have several payments that were tendered and accepted late, but within 10 days. What we have also is we have some payments that were tendered and accepted late that were accepted more than 10 days late. However, there is no evidence in this case that Mercedes-Benz ever expressly waived anything. So what we're looking at, if we're looking at a waiver at all, we're looking at a waiver by implication. Now what we've got to find is some decisive act that means waiver or that is so inconsistent with the rights of the creditor that it has to be deemed a waiver. What we've got is we've got Mercedes-Benz accepting a late payment. However, to the extent those payments were more than 10 days late, Mercedes-Benz always treated them as a default, always imposed the late fee, that is, the remedy of its late fee, and more significantly, in every case, Mr. Ryan paid that late fee as a consequence. Both parties in that situation always confirmed the agreement as in accordance with its original terms.
So any time a creditor accepts, charges a late fee and accepts it, that is not, cannot be implied waiver under those circumstances.
Your Honor, if that's all there is, then we submit that that's the case. And the reason why is because that is not inconsistent with the creditor's rights under the original agreement, under the agreement's original terms.
Well, it's inconsistent with, so if there's a right to accelerate and to repossess, isn't it?
The creditor in a secure transaction has a number of different remedies, and I think it's always been the law that the creditor can kind of pick and choose what remedies it wants to. Now, if we've got a sort of, if you think about it in terms of sort of a mini remedy, that is, we've got a late fee, then I think the question that the court has to grapple with is, if the debtor is a little bit late, and the creditor has a remedy of a late fee, do we want to say that by the creditor exercising that mini remedy, if you will, that the creditor waives other remedies in the event the default gets greater? We submit to you that that is not good public policy.
Don't you think that Mr. Byrne probably felt that, being that Mercedes consistently allowed him to pay late, that he was surprised about the fact that his truck was going to be repossessed?
Well,
in other words, he was lulled into complacency about the whole issue because of Mercedes' practices.
Your Honor, we don't think so. In the first place, on the facts, he testified that he always knew that he was late and that he was prepared to pay the late fee. So to that extent, I don't think he was ever lulled to sleep on the facts in this case. More to the point generally, prior to the revision agreement or the extension agreement, which occurred in September of 1987, prior to that time, there were a number of late payments. However, one of them, only one of them, was greater than 10 days late. In fact, it was the July payment immediately before the extension. That was the only payment that was more than 10 days late, and I believe, if I'm correct, it was 14 or 15 days late. So at that point, I don't think he can claim any surprise at anything. In fact, he contacted Mercedes-Benz to say, look, I'm having a little trouble here. What I'd like to do is put some payments to the rear, which Mercedes-Benz agreed to do for him. And they then entered into that agreement, all other terms remaining the same. It was only after that that he started to get later and later and later, and each time he was, late fees were imposed and he paid them. It is our position that when that happened, and that is all consistent with the contract, so it's our position that when that happened, both parties confirmed the original contract.
What was the late fee? How much was the late fee?
Your Honor, it was $5.
And he would just add that on to his payment?
The facts are not real clear in terms of how it came up. He apparently was billed the amount. In any event, the amount was added on periodically. For example, there would be one check submitted, for example, that would be the regular payment plus $10. There would be another check another time that was tendered for the regular payment plus maybe $15. So they were added in and paid right along with the regular payment. There is no question in this case that Mr. Rhine was in default at the time truck number one was repossessed. He admitted that he was 17 days behind. In fact, he insisted on it on numerous occasions. So, you look at the creditor's remedy in that situation. UCC section 9.503 says, in the event of default, the creditor may repossess the collateral. Now, you may hear reference made to a notice of acceleration. Mercedes-Benz sent a notice of acceleration to Mr. Rhine. Mr. Rhine admitted that he received it. However, the trial court found that notice of acceleration was not preceded by a notice of intention to accelerate. Therefore, the trial court concluded that the acceleration of the maturity of the debt was not proper. We do not claim that the acceleration was proper. However, acceleration is not part of this case. It is not a requirement of repossession under section 9.503 that the maturity of the debt be accelerated. The only requirement is that the debtor be in default.
What does the contract require?
Pardon me, Your Honor.
What did the contract require, the installment sales contract? What was your obligation? Did you have to give a notice of intent to accelerate? Did you have to then give a follow-up notice of foreclosure?
The contract was silent after that. Under the law, there was an option to accelerate, so under the law, it required two notices. It required a notice of intent to accelerate and the notice of acceleration.
Did the agreement provide for waivers by Mr. Rhine of all these types of things?
Under the current state of the law, the agreement could have provided for a waiver if the waiver language was very, very specific, that the buyer, that the borrower was waiving the right, the notice of intention to accelerate, and or also the notice of acceleration. And I believe the state of the law is those waivers would have been good. They were not in the contract.
Mr. Kelly, how many late payments could Mercedes-Benz have accepted over the course of this contract before a waiver could be implied? Could a waiver be implied at all, is my question.
I think my answer to that would have to be, so long as Mercedes-Benz was accepting payments and asserting its right under the terms of the contract, that is, by deeming it in default and imposing its late charges, then I think that would not be a waiver. Now, I can hypothesize facts that might result in an estoppel under various facts, but I don't think we have anything like that in this case.
How many late payments in this case did Mercedes-Benz accept before the truck was repossessed?
Prior to, I've got it broken up into two groups, Your Honor. Prior to the September extension agreement, I believe there were 16 total payments. I believe that 13 of those payments were late, that 12 of those payments were late by less than 10 days, and that the July payment was 14 or 15 days late. The August payment was also more than 10 days late, but it was at that time the parties were talking to each other about, you know, can we do an extension agreement, which they did. So that meant then that the August and September payment were put off to the end of the contract. They were moved back 42 more months. Then the October payment was a little, the October payment, I want to say, was about 18 or 20 days late, and thereafter he was late, and late charges, he was more than 10 days late every month thereafter, and late charges were imposed and paid every time.
And at what point during, after the delay, after setting the, a couple of payments to the end of the contract term, and then the other three late payments, and Mercedes-Benz say they're not going to take any more, I mean, they'd write him and say, that's it. You had 13, 14, 25 chances. You haven't responded, so that's it. We expect the next payment to be on time, or that's it. I mean, did that occur?
They did not send that letter. The only letter that they sent that the trial court found was the notice of acceleration, and it, as I mentioned, was ineffective as an acceleration. There is language in there that is
unmistakable. That was before the repossession.
That was before the repossession, yes, Your Honor. That was March 10th. The repossession was May 3rd, I believe. There is evidence that there were a couple of phone calls, but to answer your specific question, no, a letter was not sent that said specifically, you have been in default, and you know, we expect timely performance henceforth, or we're going to repossess.
Is the evidence clear that that letter was even received by the Burns?
The notice of acceleration?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, Mr. Ryan admitted that he received that letter. We have the issue, an issue in this case that is germane to waiver is how far behind was Mr. Ryan at the time the vehicle was repossessed. Now, I mentioned that Mr. Ryan testified repeatedly that he was only 17 days behind. However, that is not evidence that the court needs to concern itself with, and the reason is this. Mr. Ryan, when confronted with his documents, that is his canceled checks, his check stubs, and his bank statements, conceded that if Mercedes-Benz was correct and that check 3006 did not include the October payment, then Mr. Ryan conceded that he was two payments behind at that time. He conceded that he was incorrect, that he was only 17 days behind, and he conceded that Mercedes-Benz had a right to repossess that truck under those circumstances. Now, the evidence that Mr. Ryan purports to rely on to the justification in support of that position is a notation at the bottom of check 3006. The Court of Appeals and the trial court both interpreted that notation as meaning that the October payment amount was included in that check. Both courts erred in that. And the reason they did was because there was a contemporaneous document executed by the same party on the same day covering the same material that both courts failed to consider. This court has stated the rules of construction numerous times. Number one, ascertain the intention of the parties. Number two, if there are multiple writings that are executed by the same parties contemporaneously dealing with the same subject matter, then the court must interpret those writings together as a single writing. Third, if there are two provisions that purport to be in conflict, then the interpretation should be such that it avoids the conflict and harmonizes the provisions if that is possible. And most importantly, interpretation of a writing that is unambiguous is a question of law that this court can review de novo. Look at the extension agreement. It is Plaintiff's Exhibit Number 9. That extension agreement was executed by Bernice Ryan, Mr. Ryan's wife. He testified that that was her handwriting, and he testified that she had authority to sign that document on his behalf. That document is dated September 8th. That document bears the account number of the account for truck one, and that document says total amount due, $1,491.94. Now, compare that to the check that has the notation at the bottom. It was also signed by Bernice Rhine. It is dated September 8th, the same day. It has on it the identical account number as the extension agreement. It is payable to Mercedes-Benz in the amount of $1,491.94, to the penny, the amount stated as due in the extension agreement. There is no question that these two writings are all part of the same transaction.
Any other questions? Thank you, Commissioner.
May I please report, Mr. Lucas Foles will put an argument for response.
May I please report, distinguished counsel. This is a statutory DTPA and UCC case. Important, I think it is at the outset to review the, or at least recognize what the standard of review is in this case as far as the evidence is concerned. Under Poole and Ames, all of the conflicting evidence must be resolved in favor of Mr. Rhine, who is the counterclaimant, the prevailing party in this case, and all inferences, reasonable inferences from that evidence must be resolved in favor of Mr. Rhine. One of the remarkable aspects of the briefing here by the petitioner is that it's a revisionist approach to what the evidence is. It talks about the evidence that Mercedes-Benz put in, but it never talks about the evidence that Mr. Rhine put in.
Well, there are findings of fact and conclusions of law in this case, isn't that right?
There are findings of fact and conclusions of law, and those findings of fact and conclusions, well, the findings of fact are uniformly in favor of Mr. Rhine, and the evidence in support of those, the evidence should be the conflicting evidence. The reasonable evidence in favor of those kind of findings of fact, of course.
Well, but they have to be supported by
some evidence. By some evidence.
Under no evidence review.
Exactly. And Mr. Rhine did put in evidence.
Well, then what's our standard review on the conclusions of law?
On the conclusions of law, it's de novo, Your Honor, of course.
So what's your answer to the implied waiver?
Okay. Getting to the issue of waiver. The credit performance, the history of the credit performance in this case is that for a period of something over a year, Mr. Rhine was at sometimes on time, but nearly always so late with his
first. Do you agree with his argument that there's no express waiver in the case?
There is an express waiver in the case.
Right. Where did we find that?
Mr. Krieger's testimony, Mr. Rhine testified, Mr. Krieger told him that as long as the payments came within 30 days, there would be no repossession.
Was that on the first truck or the second truck?
That's on both trucks. And it was reaffirmed in connection with the second truck. At the time of the repossession, check number 3006 had been paid in September. Mr. Rhine reviewed that check. And the check plainly says it's a payment plus the construction of that in support of the findings of fact is that it was a payment. Since both August and September payments were moved to the end of the contract, that is the payment for October. It was paid in September, but for October. After that point, as you track through the payments, when you get to the point where Bisson follows Rhine out of Far Texas to Beaumont. Mr. Rhine is only 17 days late on his payment. He is within the 30 days that he has been told is accepted. He has been at times almost 60 days late, one time. But most of the time, after the payments were moved, he had four payments that were about 30 days late, up until the time he was repossessed.
But by your argument, that means there's no extension charge in that check.
There were, yes, there were extensions, there were $15 in that check, in check number 3006, there were $15 in late charges. plus some almost $70 in charges to move the two payments to the end of the contract and a payment. This testimony is...
Well, by that, you mean there's only $70 for the extension fee charge in the Mr. Ryan's view?
That's correct. And, of course...
What does that do to the usury claim?
Well, the usury claim was an alternative claim from the outset, in my
abandoning
view.
Abandoning that?
Pardon me?
Are you abandoning the usury claim?
Yes, sir. Our primary concern here, our primary argument here is that this charge was a payment, Justice Baker. If it wasn't a payment, it would be usurious. Recall, however, that already built into each one of these payments is a time price differential interest charge.
Well, but is there any dispute that they could charge consideration to agree to move two payments to the end?
They could do so, but under the UCC, it is not necessary that that be supported by
the But they agreed, assuming this agreement that he refers to, that was part of the agreement between the parties for the extension.
All right, now then, you're taking me to the revision agreement, which I will just move to so that we can discuss that. Mr. Ryan did not admit that Mrs. Ryan's signature is on Exhibit 9. They popped this exhibit up in the courtroom. It had never been produced in discovery. The judge overruled the objections to it. Mr. Ryan said he'd never seen it before, and he didn't know whether that was her signature. And then he was asked, well, would she have been authorized to sign such an agreement? He said yes, but he never identified her signature. And Judge Moncias specifically in his findings of fact found that exhibit was not credible. In fact, the record would suggest that exhibit was fabricated by MBCC.
The extension agreement
that they claimed was...
But you agree that the check's okay.
The check was signed and sent by her.
It has the same signature on it.
It has a signature, yes, sir. It does have a valid signature.
And it did go into evidence.
The check did go into evidence.
And yes. Did the...
Exhibit 9 was also admitted in evidence and then later found by the judge in his findings of fact to be not credible. That's how that was handled. So, under the reasonable inferences that should be given in support of the trial court's findings of fact, these are not contemporaneous documents, and one does not, Exhibit 9 cannot be used to interpret the meaning of the check.
They were both dated the same day, September 8th. Is that right or wrong?
Your Honor, I can't answer that. I think they are dated. They probably are dated
well,
the same day.
Well, would you agree if they're dated the same day, that's pretty contemporaneous?
If they were signed, if they were both signed by her, which Exhibit 9, there's no evidence that it was signed by her.
Was she deceased at the time of the trial?
At the time of trial, she was deceased. Yes, Your Honor. Now, there was...
And he is deceased now.
And he is now deceased, yes, Your Honor. We lost him very recently.
So, I guess something filed, suggestion of death, or something?
I just haven't gotten that done, but I will. But under the San Antonio real estate case, these are cases from this court, Puckett versus Hoover, I think it is, Ford versus Culberson, these the cases that we cite in our brief, Mr. Ryan was not in default, or if he was in technical default, the technical default had been waived by Mercedes-Benz, and he was in compliance with his contract.
How do you deal with the wouldn't a letter of acceleration put Mr. Ryan back on notice that they weren't giving up their right to come after the truck?
I'd like to get to that now, Your Honor. The so-called letter of acceleration was not even addressed to Mr. Ryan. That's the only letter that he got from Mercedes-Benz. And it was addressed to a James Estep, someone Mr. Ryan, if it is a real name, had never heard of before. So this letter that they say it constitutes this notice of acceleration, not preceded by a notice of intent, never, and they never gave a request to repossess or a notice of repossession of any kind. This only letter that they ever sent called a notice of acceleration was not even addressed to Norman Ryan or Marcella Ryan. It was addressed to James Estep Estep.
But Mr. Ryan got it, if I understand the right.
He received it. Yes, it came to his residence, and he got it. Yeah. And it caused him some concern. He testified about that.
So he was aware, even though another name was on it, that it pertained to his account with Mercedes.
I think that the inference that must be given there is that he was not aware.
Well, then why was he concerned?
Because it was something from his creditor talking about a default, but it wasn't addressed to him.
Mm-hmm. Did he do anything after he received that letter?
After he received that letter, Your Honor, I cannot remember whether he paid, whether that letter, I can't remember the date of that letter. He made a payment on April the 14th. And I can't remember whether that's after that letter came or before. But he did make his last payment on April the 14th of 1988, which was the March 14th payment. He was 30 days late on that one. Now these are the dates I'm giving you. The dates I'm giving you that when he paid is when Mercedes Credit received and posted the payment. He had mailed the payment earlier, obviously, because it got to them and they posted on these dates. A creditor who gets into this situation of waiver is not helpless. This court's opinion in the A.L. Carter Lumber Company spells out precisely what that creditor is to do. And the amici need not be concerned because this court has given direction since 1943 what they are to do. They notify the debtor that they will no longer receive late payments and they must give reasonable time to perform. Probably that may include moving some payments to the end if they have let a debtor get late rather than get all the money up front if they can't get the money caught up immediately. But that's all something that must be a reasonable opportunity for performance provided under the A.L. Carter Lumber Company.
Looks like that would be an incentive not to cut anybody any slack. Be pretty tight about it.
Well, this is interesting and on the facts of this case. Right after Mercedes-Benz Credit Corporation put the two payments, August and September, to the end of the Truck One note, Mercedes-Benz Credit Corporation made Mr. Ryan a loan on Truck Two. So they obviously considered him creditworthy. We're in the mid-80s. A lot of people were having cash flow problems in the mid-80s. But I think that the creditor has to read whatever they read into any particular credit to determine whether or not they think it's still an ongoing creditworthy situation or whether they foreclose, repo, and take their lunch. Obviously, in this situation, they felt that Mr. Ryan was still creditworthy because they made him a loan after they did that.
If you were a creditor and were going to be perfectly careful about it, if somebody was even a day late, you send them a notice of intent, notice of acceleration, and then I suppose they'd pay up. Then you'd have an agreement to go forward until the next late payment.
If they could. Now, at some point, obviously, the transaction cost justifies that. But people are late on their house payments, they're late on their car payments, they have illnesses. A lot of reasons why people don't perform exactly on time. Particularly in the consumer credit area. And people accept those payments late and they go on and people turn out to continue to be credit worthy and everybody's happy. So they don't send mail and stamps and computer letters and all that. It's not just programmed in. But at some point, if it becomes intolerable, then the provisions of the A.L. Carter Lumber Company have to be met. Mercedes-Benz never took any steps to comply with A.L. Carter Lumber Company requirements.
Well, that argument is premised on waiver existing. Is that correct?
It is.
So the key issue is whether there's a flat waiver.
Well, that's correct. But the cases that the cases from this court that underpin the waiver issue are the San Antonio Real Estate, Puckett versus Hoover, and Ford versus Culberson.
If I understand correctly, you're even if there's no implied waiver, you say there's express waiver here.
Both.
So Mercedes-Benz would not have been within its rights to demand to repossess as long as the payments were no later than 30 days overdue under the express waiver that you spoke of earlier. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct, under that express waiver. Under the implied waiver, I don't know how long it goes, because I think at some point, if there's been a series of times, and for example, the February 14th payment was made or was credited at Mercedes-Benz on March the 28th. So that's February 14th, March 14th, March 28th. That's 6 weeks left. But at some point, the creditor has got to comply with the AL Carter requirements in order to get the credit back on track.
Why? Opposing counsel says by charging the late fee, which was paid by Mr. Ryan, that it preserved its other rights under the credit agreement. Would you respond to that?
My response to that, Your Honor, is that there's absolutely no precedent for that anywhere. There's nothing in the contract that says that. They have the right. They have a processing fee. I'm assuming they have some processing costs when the payment doesn't hit right on time. They have the right to charge late payments under the Consumer Credit Code, and they did. But it doesn't have a thing to do with waiver. There's not a case anywhere. They don't cite a case that the payment and collection of the late fee causes the waiver to disappear. If anything, the only so-called 10, they call a 10-day grace period. I'm sure you've seen that in your papers. This so-called grace period is a period in which a payment will be received late without a late charge. After that, a payment that is received late is assessed a late charge. But that's all so-called late charges. It doesn't have anything to do with the timeliness of future payments.
Is it your position that there was no written extension agreement?
Yes.
But...
And it's I'm sorry.
What was Mr. Ryan's testimony that he knew it had been extended?
Well, it's undisputed, and that's also back at pages 1002 and 1003 in that area. It's undisputed. It was undisputed in the entire trial that the August and September payments were put to the end of the contract.
But there was no written agreement.
There was no written agreement, unless it was Exhibit 9. And if it was Exhibit 9, if that was a valid exhibit, why wasn't it produced during discovery? And why was it just popped up in court on examination by Mr. Ryan, by NBC's counsel, without ever having shown it to anybody? And Mr. Ryan says, I've never seen this before. So I say there's no written agreement. I think that the reasonable inferences in this case dictate that there is no written agreement to do so. However, it's undisputed that those two payments were put to the end of the contract. The damages in this case are significant, and I think justly so. Under the Moore versus Lillibow standard of requiring emotional pain, torment, and suffering, extending beyond the Parkway versus Woodruff, mere worry, anxiety, vexation, embarrassment, anger, the Moore versus Lillibow standard is met here. Mr. Ryan was a gentleman of age 77. He was not a sedentary retiree. He was a working man. He was an independent businessman and a farmer. He spent his life working, and he wanted to work.
But can you tell us what the damages were for mental anguish?
The damages...
What does it have to be?
It's important, I think, to note that there was no request by NBCC and the trial court to segregate the damages by item. The proof in the record supports damages of various kinds, but the bulk of the damages would, of necessity, be mental anguish damages. The damages include the damage to his credit, so he couldn't get back into business. That could be a very large number.
But just looking at the mental anguish, if we determine that had to be $500,000, and we find that there's a dollar or more, evidence of a dollar or more mental anguish under our no evidence standard, do we have any authority to look at the number, or once we determine there is some evidence of mental anguish, which is allowed by law, is that the end of our review?
What you just said is correct. That's the end of this court's review.
A convenient cite for that?
I'm sorry?
Do you have a convenient citation for that principle?
I think Benoit versus Wilson is the right site for that one, Your Honor.
Any other questions?
Does the record contain the sufficient findings to support punitive damages?
It does, Your Honor. The record contains findings that the violations were made knowingly, willfully, wantonly, and with malice. So they not only meet the DTPA, but they also meet the requirements of Krauss and of Haslip and the Supreme Court of the United States plans of requirements.
Who are the beneficiaries of this judgment if it was to be affirmed?
It would be Mr. Ryan's, of course there's not anything on the record on this, but it would be his grandchildren.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
He sold the site to A.L. Carter Lumber. Does A.L. Carter Lumber apply? If it does, do you meet it? If it doesn't, then why doesn't it?
Your Honor, A.L. Carter need not be overruled by this court in order to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals in this case. In A.L. Carter, this court held that by the conduct of the party, they had modified the agreement. Thus, payments that were originally due, and I'm sorry I forgot the actual date when they were originally due, but it was the 5th or the 8th or somewhere in that vicinity, by modification by conduct of the parties, the payments then became due on the 22nd. What we submit to you here is that because Mercedes-Benz never acted inconsistently, that is, it asserted its remedies of late charge and Mr. Ryan paid those, that we never had a modification. The parties always confirmed the agreement as originally written.
Was there a late payment after the misguided acceleration?
After the acceleration?
Letter.
There were late fees charged. Candidly, I can't recall. I don't recall if he even made any more payments after that.
If there's no written extension agreement, do you lose?
No, we don't lose if there's no written extension agreement.
Why not?
Because the most that the evidence shows is that Mr. Ryan testified that he had a conversation with the Mercedes-Benz employee saying that they were going to put a couple of payments to the back. Now, there never was any discussion whatsoever about whether there was going to be a charge for that, and if so, how much was the charge? So the charge, there's still I think there is still room here that the charge was for the extension. Now, but as a matter of fact, I do need to correct one thing, and this statement of fact is very, very lengthy, but I need to direct the court's attention to the questioning by Mr. Hull and the answering and the answers given by Mr. Ryan.
Could you give us the volume and page, please?
Yes, Your Honor. Volume 7, pages 221 and 222. Question, and they were looking at Plaintiff's Exhibit Number 9, which is the written extension agreement at the time. Question, that's your wife's handwriting? Answer, that's her, my wife's handwriting. On the next page, lines 2 through 7, question, did Bernice, that is Mrs. Ryan, did Bernice have authority to sign that document in front of you on your behalf? Answer, certainly. Okay. And then Mr. Ryan goes on to volunteer. She could sign anything that come up if I wasn't there. That written extension agreement was the agreement in this case. And just as a matter of fact, it is required under Chapter 7 of the Credit Code that an extension agreement be in writing. That extension...
But opposing counsel says the trial court is entered a finding that that exhibit is not credible.
The trial court did indeed have a finding that that document is not credible. And I'll be quite frank, Your Honor, I am at a loss as to tell you what that means. The document was admitted. Mr. Ryan testified that it was his wife's handwriting. He testified that she had authority to sign it. I don't know what it means.
Well, how can we handle that finding of fact since it's the sole prerogative of the trial court to make those assessments?
I think the way the court can handle that finding of fact is simple. There is no evidence to support that finding.
Doesn't have to be.
What about the question that this document sprung on the witness as a surprise that was never produced on discovery?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. He testified that he had not seen that document before. He then went on to testify that nonetheless it was his wife's handwriting and that she had authority to sign it.
Did he testify that the signature on the document was his wife's signature?
Yes, he did. I'm sorry. He testified that the signature was his wife's handwriting.
I thought Mr. Soles at least represented the court that there's no evidence that Mr. Ryan said that the signature of the document was his wife's.
Well, the signature was the name was Norman A. Ryan. So I mean, the name that was written on there was the name of Mr. Ryan. What he testified to was that that name was in his wife's handwriting and that she had authority to sign that document on his behalf.
Any other questions? Thank you, Kevin. That concludes the argument. On the second call, the court will now take another recess.